Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, and welcome to CFRI's CF Community Voices, coming to you from our home studio in Palo Alto, California. I'm Sue Landgraf, Executive Director of Cystic Fibrosis Research Incorporated, CFRI, and I'm very pleased to welcome our viewers and listeners. We have a very special program ahead, but before getting started, I want to thank our generous sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Chiesa USA, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, and Proteostasis Therapeutics. I also would like to note that no information presented in this podcast is intended for a patient's diagnosis or treatment. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you, and let's get started.
Hi, I'm Julie Mattel, and I'm the dietitian at the CF Center at Stanford Children's Hospital, and it's my pleasure to be here today to talk to you about gastrostomy tubes and cystic fibrosis. So what we hope to cover today is the what, when, why, and how of using G-tubes, and we'd like to cover what is a G-tube, when do we consider placing a G-tube, why should we place a G-tube, and finally, how are G-tubes placed? So to the first question, what is a G-tube? So a gastrostomy tube, or G-tube, is a long-term way to provide nutrition directly into the stomach. And there are other ways as well. There is a nasogastric tube, which is called an NG-tube. And this is a more temporary way to provide nutrition. Or a GJ or NJ tube, which is a similar device, but it goes, instead of the stomach, it goes into the jejunum. So this next slide shows gives you a pictorial representation of what a G-tube looks like. So on the left-hand side of the slide, you can see that the G-tube is placed with an extension that goes through the abdominal wall into the stomach directly, and then it's held in place there with an inflatable balloon. And then the outside of the G-tube looks a little bit like a valve that you would see on a pool toy that you can open and close. And we can then connect a tube that we can feed through using either a syringe or a pump. And then on the right-hand side of your slide, you can see an NG tube and how that differs. The tube is fed through the nose and into the stomach. And this is a more temporary device. There are different types of G-tubes, as I just mentioned. More options today in 2017 than there were in 1888. So this graphic representation shows sort of what it would look like to receive a G-tube feed many, many years ago. So now to the when. When is a G-tube recommended? So ideally, we'd like individuals to eat by mouth, but sometimes it's not possible or adequate. And some examples of when that is not able to happen is when a person has perhaps a swallow defect or there's concern for aspirating food contents into the lungs, or perhaps an individual just doesn't have the appetite to meet their caloric requirements. And in cystic fibrosis, there are varying reasons as well when a G-tube might be indicated. People with CF have increased energy needs because of inflammation in their lungs, infection, coughing, or they have impaired absorption of nutrients from their intestines. And finally, they might have a decreased appetite when they have infections or other GI problems such as constipation. Before going forward, I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about why nutrition is important in cystic fibrosis. We do know that good nutrition is associated with better growth, appropriate onset of puberty, achieving normal vitamin and mineral levels, better immune function, bone density, also less severe lung disease, slower disease progression, and finally better health. And this next slide sort of gives you some research evidence to support that. So this these data come from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation registry data, and it shows several graphs. On the left-hand side of the screen, these are graphs of children, and on the right-hand side, adults. And these graphs compare body mass index, which is a measure of weight compared to height, to lung function, which is the vertical axis, which is percent predicted for FEV1. And as you can see, as BMI percentiles, or the absolute value of BMI for adults, increases, lung function increases as well. And that increase occurs until about the 50th percentile is achieved for BMI for kids, or a BMI of 22 for females and 23 for adults. And that's where we came up with the goals for BMI in individuals with CF. So a G-tube is not our first option. There are things that we try first, usually, to try and improve nutrition. We can try and increase calories with adding high-calorie additives to meals or providing supplements like milkshakes, smoothies, high-calorie commercial supplements. We also want to make sure that individuals with CF are receiving adequate enzyme therapy so that malabsorption doesn't become a component with this. Also, treating conditions that decrease appetite, such as reflux, constipation, lung infections, and sinus disease. And here we might consider appetite stimulants as well in order to sort of help people achieve a better appetite so they can eat more and get enough calories. Also, improved feeding behaviors becomes a focus for some patients and some families. Over time, when individuals grow up with CF, maladaptive feeding behaviors can set in because parents are so invested in trying to get their kids to gain weight that sometimes it has a negative impact. And so we try and look for those and ways that we can help with the feeding behaviors. And then finally, we get the GI service involved, the GI doctors, to try and address other issues such as lactose intolerance, celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease. And we're also checking for other issues that can cause poor nutrition, such as uncontrolled diabetes or CF liver disease. Okay, next to the why. Why should we place a G-tube? So if individuals have tried all of these things and we've worked out the calories in the diet, optimizing enzymes, appetite stimulants, addressing feeding behaviors, that might be the time where we consider a G-tube and we tried all of these other things. And we definitely need to pay attention to the social and emotional burdens of meeting these calorie needs. I also wanted to touch on sort of the research behind G-tubes and what is it in CF. You know, do G-tubes really work with folks with CF? So there's a whole host of research out there. I wanted to just sort of highlight some of the most recent studies. These were conducted in the UK as well as the United States, Israel, and Australia. And the number of subjects varies in these studies, with the largest study, the study by Best in 2011, where they had 46 patients. And these patients were followed anywhere from 1 year to 4.5 years following a G-tube placement. And the individuals that participated had different levels of lung function. And what the studies suggested was that weight for height and BMI did indeed improve significantly following a G-tube placement, and that improvement lasted for 2 to 3 years after the G-tube was placed. Pulmonary function or lung function remained stable, and in one study actually improved, the largest study by Best et al. Feeds were well tolerated by most. Complications were mild, included things like leakage, local irritation and pain, skin infections, some reflux symptoms, vomiting, bedwetting, and night sweats. So the conclusion of these studies was that G-tubes really are a safe and effective way to improve the nutritional status of individuals with CF. They were mainly well tolerated. Some of the findings, though, did suggest that patients with advanced lung disease or reflux, and also females, did have poorer outcomes after G-tubes were placed. But a more recent, larger study by Best did show that there was really no correlation between the degree of lung function when the tube was placed and clinical outcomes after G-tubes are placed. So now I'd like to turn the talk over to Dr. Sellers, who's going to continue on with how G-tubes are placed and a little bit more about the procedures.
Thank you, Julie. My name is Zachary Sellers. I'm a pediatric gastroenterology fellow at Stanford. And I'm going to talk about how G-tubes are placed. Now, first, when the decision has been made to put a G-tube in, it's important that there's consensus between the patient, the family, and the CF and gastroenterology teams. And it's important that everyone feels comfortable moving forward. If you haven't already, there will be a consultation with a gastroenterologist and or a surgeon. And they'll during that visit, they'll go over what is expected, and we'll cover a little bit of that today. First of all, before the procedure, we'll check labs, we'll do some imaging, make sure that there's no anatomical considerations that we need to think about and that the patient is in relatively good health. Of course, we'll ensure that there is adequate insurance coverage, both for the procedure itself and also for the supplies and nutrition that will be needed afterwards. And then even before we do the procedure, we meet closely as the gastroenterologists and the dietitians to come up with a tentative feeding plan. What do we expect? Will we have daytime feeds? Will we have nighttime feeds? What kind of formula do we think we'll use? And we put together what we think we'll need for our enzyme use. Just briefly, I want to talk about what you might expect when you're going to have a G-tube placed. First of all, you'll come into the hospital sometimes a few days before, depending on your lung health. We want to make sure that the procedure is done safely, and so because the procedure requires anesthesia, then we'll make sure that the lung health is as good as it can be. Sometimes that may require IV antibiotics or increased airway clearance therapy. On the day of the procedure, I'll talk about in a couple minutes what will be done, but after the procedure is done, you can expect a few days to remain in the hospital. This is so that we can get good pain control. Usually the pain is only localized to the area where the G-tube is placed, and that pain improves after a couple of days. But then we gradually and slowly increase use of the G-tube, first with clear liquids and then formula, and then we want to make sure that the patient tolerates the feedings well before they go home. We also provide teaching to the patient and the family so that they feel comfortable when they go home to be able to do this themselves. Of course, when you go home, you're not left to just do it by yourself, so that we continue to work closely with patients and families to help them troubleshoot and provide education on an ongoing basis. We hope to resume airway clearance therapy soon after G-tube's placed, and in general, we're pretty successful with this. So there's two main types of G-tubes that we place, and there are many other sort of variations, but I'm going to talk about the two broad types. The first is what we call a percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy. Most oftentimes you hear it referred to as a PEG tube. And this is typically performed by a gastroenterologist, although a surgeon and or an interventional radiologist can also place these. As gastroenterologists, we perform this endoscopically, and the patient will undergo general anesthesia, and we use an endoscope, which is a flexible tube with a camera on the end of it and has a light as well, so we can see where we're going. We put that endoscope through the mouth, into the esophagus, and into the stomach. Once we're in the stomach, we can see the inside of the stomach, and we can localize the best place to put the G-tube. Once we do that, we can actually see that light through the stomach wall and onto the skin on the outside, and then we will poke a hole through the abdominal wall into the stomach, and then place the PEG tube through that. On the middle bottom part of the slide there, you can see an example of a PEG tube. And you can see that at the bottom it has two discs. Both of those are used to keep the G-tube in place. One of the discs is on the outer part of the abdominal wall, and the other disc is on the inside of the stomach. And both of those allow sort of cinching to keep the G-tube in place. Sometimes patients will keep this PEG tube indefinitely, and other times they will elect to change it to a low-profile G-tube, and that's typically done after 3 months after the tract where the G-tube was initially placed has healed. The other type of G-tube is a low-profile G-tube. The most common type that we use is a Mickey button. There are also barred buttons. These are trade names of different types. And these are not performed by gastroenterologists, but are actually performed by surgeons. At Stanford Children's, it's our pediatric general surgeons that place these. And this is most oftentimes done laparoscopically, but depending on the circumstance, can be done open as well. Laparoscopically, they'll go through the belly button, and they find the stomach, and then they put stitches in, putting the stomach to the abdominal wall, and then they, once they identify the ideal place to put the G-tube, then they will, in the same way that we do, poke a hole through and insert the G-tube directly in. Now, these G-tubes, as you can see in the picture, as Julie explained, kind of look like a valve. And so when you're not feeding, they're small, and you can close that valve. Either there's a balloon to keep it in place that's filled with water, or there's a small sort of mushroom tip that keeps it in place. But when you need to feed, then a tube is connected to the valve, and that allows you to put your feeds through into the stomach. Now, I mentioned that most of our patients get a Mickey button or a low-profile G-tube, but depending on the situation, one might elect to have a PEG tube. Here, we've put together a couple of pros and cons about PEG tubes or Mickey or low-profile tubes. And of course, when you're considering which one is best for you, it's best to talk with your gastroenterologist or surgeon to see what they would recommend. But in general, the reason why we tend to use more low-profile G-tubes or Mickey buttons is because, as you saw in the picture, they're smaller, they're more discreet, they're able to fit under the clothing or easily. They can be replaced at home. They're typically replaced every 3 months, and in the initial time is done in the office with us or with the surgeons. But after that, we provide training as for the parents or the patient to be able to do that at home, and so that provides a lot of flexibility. Now, the downsides to them is that the balloon can leak over time and it can also break, and that's actually why we change it every 3 months, because the balloon will weaken over time. Now, this is in compared to a PEG G-tube, which does not need to be changed every few months and is more durable and also is less likely to become dislodged. Once you have your G-tube in place, that's not the end of what you need. There are other supplies that you'll need in order to do your G-tube feedings. Of course, you'll need formula or blenderized food to be able to go through it. That goes into a bag with tubing, and then a pump is used to deliver that through the G-tube. Of course, many individuals need pancreatic enzymes to digest their food, so we work with our dietitians to determine the right amount and the right types of pancreatic enzymes and to add those to the food that you're getting. Of course, while we find a lot of benefit from G-tubes, there are problems that can arise with them. The most common complication that we see is leaking around the G-tube. This occurs most commonly with the balloon-based G-tubes because, as I mentioned, they can leak, and then also the sizing sometimes is not appropriate. Sometimes we put these in infants, and then they grow as we expect, and so we have to continually change the size of the G-tubes. And when we don't get it quite right, then sometimes we can have some leaking, and we need to play around with that a little bit. But don't worry, we have in the gastroenterology division, we have gastroenterologists and also our GI nurses that are very capable and skilled in helping you to work through these problems. Now, of course, we always counsel people that if the G-tube comes out, then it is important to put it back in. The hole where the G-tube is placed will close back up, and especially if it's been in only for a few months, then that hole can close quite rapidly. So we always make sure that families and patients have extra G-tube supplies at home should they need to put another one in. We can also use a Foley catheter just to put something in the hole until a new one can be put in. Now, those people that have a gastrostomy tube for longer than 3 months and the hole in which it was placed is well healed, then they can just replace it at home with no problem. But if it's been less than 3 months, it's important to seek medical attention so we can verify that it's been placed in the right position before feeds are restarted. Now, we also have some complications that we can run into as we're doing G-tube feeds. First of all, since we're giving more calories, oftentimes we patients report that they have increased fullness, decreased appetite. Depending on what time of the day the feeds are being given, if they're given overnight, then sometimes they'll wake up and not feel hungry for breakfast. And so our number one priority is to have people continue to eat by mouth and not take that hunger drive away. And so we'll adjust our feedings as best we can to ensure that the patient can continue to eat by mouth and also supplement appropriately. If we give too much volume at one time in the stomach, patients can vomit, and so we ask them to give us feedback, and then we can adjust the volume and the rates at which we're doing that. Of course, with more equipment, as anyone knows that has these, they can alarm, you can get tube blockages, and that can wake people up in the middle of the night and just create some more stress. And of course, it's important if you're taking enzymes to give adequate enzymes with your feed so that you can digest the food appropriately. After your G-tube is placed, not all is done. We continue to work with you to optimize your nutrition. You'll continue to get close nutritional monitoring in CF clinic with our dietitians. We also have you continue to see us in gastroenterology clinic so we can ensure that not only are you achieving good weight gain, but also that the G-tube site looks healthy and that you're not having any problems that we need to troubleshoot. We are constantly sort of adjusting how much formula one may need to gain weight. Everyone has different needs at different times in their life, and so it's not a one-size-fits-all formula at any given time in your life. And we work with you to find a routine that works for you. You know, these feeds can be disruptive, but we try to find what works with your lifestyle and so that you can continue to participate in all the daily activities that you would want to do. One of the nice things to use it for as well is that liquid medicines that don't taste very well can also be placed in the G-tube. So a lot of patients like that as well. And many of our patients have their G-tubes for a long time, but it's not a permanent solution. So if your health improves and you're able to keep the nutritional needs only by eating by mouth, then the G-tube can be removed and a few stitches are placed in the hole, and there's just a very small scar where it was. So there are a few take-home points that Julie and myself would like you to remember. First of all, a G-tube can be very beneficial to CF patients in supporting their large caloric needs. We oftentimes find that we're having a joint struggle with patients and families about, need more nutrition, eat more. And so this can be a way to provide some supplement and achieve better health. For most of our CF patients, the G-tubes are not meant to replace oral feedings, but actually to supplement them. And so most of their nutrition is by mouth, and this just allows for some extra nutrition. Oftentimes we find that people are hesitant to put G-tubes in, and so they wait and wait and wait, and over time they're weight continues to go down and down, and then this can affect their lungs as well, and they can become sicker and sicker. What we think is best is that when it looks like there's starting to be a problem, that we think about a G-tube. We may not need to put it in right at that moment, but the more we think about it, then we can put it in earlier rather than later. And what we found is when we do that, we're able to correct the nutritional defect earlier, and that leads to better health in individuals. And of course, the decision to get a G-tube is not unilateral. It's not made just by your gastroenterologist. It's not made just by your CF team. It is really a joint decision that should be made between you, the gastroenterologist, and the CF team. So we put together some online resources for you. Feedingtubeawareness.org has some good resources about gastrostomy and feeding tubes. Kidshealth.org is another place that has good information. And then some of you may know that Boomer Esiason is an ex-football player, and his son, Gunnar Esiason, has CF, and he has a G-tube. And he's put together several videos that can be found on the internet through YouTube about what it's like to have a G-tube. And so I'd invite you to check those out as well. Thank you.